This is session 225 of the Sunstone Symposium, titled Triangles of Shame, Adoption Within Mormonism. Now before we begin, please turn off your cell phones. And remember that this is a respectful symposium, so if you have questions and answers at the end, make sure that we do it in a respectful way. This session is being recorded, so even though we can count everybody on our hands at the moment, it will go out to hundreds of people, and so we can and you can get a copy of this session and any other session that you may have missed. I'm missing like five other sessions that I want to go to right now, just like the rest of you. but you can get those on a USB flash drive that you can like plug into your car or put it on disk or something. And you can do that down at the registration desk, either right after the session or sometime later. Also, consider buying some books from Benchmark Books and also from the sellers downstairs and support our local Mormon people. This session is 60 minutes long, and I will make sure that you stick to that. We will have a question and answer period at the end if we have any time left. Mormonism has a unique relationship with adoption that culminates in the doctrine and ordinance of sealing. While powerful in its eternal implications, many of the root ideas surrounding this doctrine are problematic to the psychological, emotional, and physical health of persons involved in the adoption triangle, adoptee, birth parents, and adoptive parents. This paper identifies shame cycles in specific Mormon culture and impact that impact adoption triangle identities and relationships. It also explores current social science theories that can aid and empower individuals, couples, and families to act in wisdom and in order. Christy Crow Hughes, who is our presenter, is an adult adoptee who was relinquished through LDS Family Services as an infant. Her formative years were spent in Japan and Hawaii, where she lived as a minority. She holds a BA in English from BYU and has worked as a special education instructor, publicist, and librarian. And as the brother-in-law to people who have three adopted children, I'm very interested in hearing what you have to say.
First off, I want to thank you for being here with me. When we know better, we do better, and I hope that you'll leave this room knowing better. I'll be using the pronoun we throughout this paper because in preparation for writing this paper, I've actually interviewed 20 adoptees, and each one has indicated to me that they have felt utterly alone in their adoption journey. And so because adoption is typically an isolating experience, I'm going to be using the plural we. In fact, in my own family, my siblings and I are all adopted. And yet, it wasn't until I began preparing this paper that I asked them specifically what adoption has meant for them. When I spoke to my brother, he specifically said, "I can't believe we've never talked about this before. I can't believe it either, and I've asked myself why." I propose that it is because the legacy of adoption is shame on all three sides of the triangle. And this shame shuts us up, it isolates us, and even makes us sick. The antidote to shame is airing out our secrets, telling our stories, not for shock or dramatics, but rather to ignite connection and compassion. As you sit here this hour, I'm going to ask a lot of you. I'm going to ask you to take a journey with me, one that is likely to make you deeply uncomfortable. You will probably want to find someone or something to blame. I get that. I've wanted to blame too. Blame allows us to control and disassociate from our pain, but I'm going to ask you to push through that impulse and instead just listen. By listening, you will become a witness to our stories. I also want to insert here that this paper is adoptee-centric, which means I'm privileging the voice of the adoptee and specifically the 20 adoptees I interviewed. The stories that I'll share are through our lens of experience, and since we had no voice at the time of our relinquishment, this is our time to report back on what adoption has meant for us. So the concept of adoption is very old. It's part of our earliest Judeo-Christian myths, and we see it woven into literature, fairy tales, TV, and even contemporary pop culture. For the most part, adoption is seen in a positive light, light as a both, excuse me, as both a way to affirm the value of life and to give children a stable, loving home if, for some reason, their biological parents are unable or unwilling to do so. And societies have always had to tackle the issue of what to do with vulnerable populations of children. It used to be that families had the implicit responsibility to care for their own, and in many cultures, this is actually still the norm. But the Western world has increasingly outsourced these tasks to governments and markets. In the 1950s, we saw a slow shift began from collective care, such as orphanages and foundling hospitals, to individual care, which includes foster care and adoption. Back then, it was rare for infants to be placed with foster families. Rather, older children were chosen by prospective parents for a variety of reasons. Think of Anne of Green Gables, who was not chosen because she needed a home, but rather because Marilla and Matthew want physical help on their farm. And because she is a girl and supposed unable to perform the physical labors they want from her, Anne initially risks getting sent back to the orphanage. Fortunately for fictional Anne, Marilla has a change of heart, but most children living out this story in real life were not so lucky. In 1916, Minnesota was the first state to make adoption records sealed from the public. The purpose of the law was to release children from the shame of illegitimacy, as many adoptable children were born to unwed mothers. Think of the word illegitimate for a moment. It means unlawful, illegal, or illicit. In other words, children born to unwed parents should not or have no right to exist. And think of the heritage of shame that label gives to a newborn baby. Along with sealed records, adoptee birth certificates were altered to reflect a rebirth into their adoptive families. For adoptees, our birth certificates are falsified documents. It is a legal fiction, but a fiction nonetheless. Really, the history of adoption and eugenic concerns go hand in hand. As America began to make the shift from collective to individual care, many were still concerned about the bad blood coursing through our veins. Eugenic ideals were expressed freely and regularly in American society and medical journals. It was commonly accepted that children who were born illegitimate came from poor stock. Illegitimacy is the result of biological, psychological, and social causes following definite scientific laws, declared Amy Watson. And prominent American psychologist Henry Hubert Goddard warned that by placing illegitimate children in good families, we run the risk of contaminating the race by the perpetuation of mental and moral deficiency, and that adoption was a crime against those yet unborn. Eugenic concerns also played a role in how professionals became involved in placing children in adoptive homes. Social workers, the public was told, could weed out genetic lemons and help prevent their defective germplasm from being mated with normal stock. Adoptive mothers were not exempt from stigma during this era either. Female infertility was often believed to be a result of female weakness. Some psychologists believed that adoption was a cure for the neurotic female mind, that placing a baby with an infertile mother would relieve her psychosis and thus allow her to conceive and carry her own biological child. The adopted child was sold as a potential cure for infertility, and it was certainly seen as a last resort when all else had failed. In the 1950s, there was a shift in adoption practices towards early placement, largely because of the work of John Bowlby, who demonstrated the harmful effects of a child deprived of maternal care and attachment. This new field of study development emphatically emphasized nurture over nature. Simultaneously, millions of unwed mothers were encouraged, often manipulated, to relinquish their babies as a way to pay penance for their crime in a period now known as the baby scoop era. In the 1980s, due to the decline of women who were willing to relinquish their babies, we saw an influx of open adoption practices, and now it has become the norm for birth parents to select adoptive parents themselves, although adoption agencies create the stage for them to find each other. Today, adoption has moved from the public sphere into the private market arena, both domestically and internationally. Adoption is looking more and more like a high-profit business. What we now have is an industrial capitalist solution to an age-old problem. As Lem Sisse says, the government, and I will insert here in America, that the market too is the farmer, the adoptive parents are the consumer, the birth mother the earth, and the baby the crop. The history of Mormon adoption practices mirrors closely the history of American adoption practices, and we see it as part of Mormon doctrine and practice almost from its inception. You may recall the story of Joseph and Emma Smith and how they lost their twin babies on the same day they were born. The following day, a friend, John Murdoch, gave his newborn twins to the Smiths because his own wife had died during childbirth. I've heard this story told several times, and each telling emphasizes the compassion that God showed Joseph and Emma for the loss of their twins. But what is not recognized is that the two babies, Julia and Joseph, lost their family and their birthright in the exchange. But this is how adoption was handled largely within the Mormon community, through verbal agreements between families and friends. In 1919, General Relief Society board member, who later became the president, Amy Brown Lyman, established the Relief Society Social Services Department, and one of their duties was to oversee adoptions. In 1969, as the church moved towards correlation, the priesthood seized control over the department and changed the name to the United Social Services, which later changed to LDS Social Services and then LDS Family Services. And as of 2014, the LDS Church is no longer participating in in-house adoptions. But because of the correlation movement, the church was able to financially subsidize adoption for its members. This allowed for couples who were not able to afford expensive private agency fees to be able to adopt. The racial practice within the LDS adoption community also mirrors American trends. Children of color were more difficult to place until about the last 10 or 15 years. Most white couples did not want to adopt outside their race, and the LDS Church limited the number of white babies per family, usually to two. If families wanted to adopt more children, transracial adoption was an option. Infants of color often lived in foster care from anywhere from 1 to 9 months before permanent placement was achieved, while most white babies were placed within a few days of birth. Some of us were given names at our birth that were either unknown or changed by our adoptive families. For infants that spent upward of 9 months in foster care, this would have been especially fracturing. White male infants were the most expensive to adopt, followed by white female infants, and children of color were far less. One adoptee put it well. She said, "We want to paint it as a beautiful picture, that it's not messy, that we are just delivered to our adopted families by a stork. We want it to be seamless and beautiful. And really, when I look at my court records, I see how much of a transaction it was. There is a monetary amount assigned to my life." It was not uncommon for race to be altered in adoption records to make an infant easier to place. One adoptee I spoke to is half Filipino, but a private agency in Utah modified her race to read half Japanese to sell her to her adoptive parents, who were white and Japanese. She was raised as a Japanese American in Utah, and it was not until she took a DNA test as an adult that she found out she's 50% Filipino and 0% Japanese. So let's move on to the first side of our triangle and talk about birth mothers. I have a short clip here, but I don't think that it's actually going to work. This is a depiction of Monica and Chandler as they're adopting their twins. And if you go back and watch it, you can see pretty clearly how the birth mother is presented as the earth and who is happy to relinquish her baby. Before open adoption practices became common, most LDS unwed mothers were seen as an embarrassment to their church community and were sent away from their homes to birth their babies, often alone, relinquish them, and then return home without anyone being the wiser. Many never told their fathers, their siblings, and later spouses or children. An adoptee I spoke with had a close-up view during the 70s. She said, "My parents fostered many children through LDS Family Services, and some of these placements were for teenage mothers who intended to place their children for adoption. I observed that being pregnant out of wedlock was a very shameful thing. So shameful, in fact, that you had to go into hiding. You had to leave your family and your friends to go with a foster family, assume a fake last name, stay out of the public school system, and no one could know where you had gone or why you had disappeared. When you had your baby, few people were allowed to see or touch it. The baby was even kept separated from the rest of the babies in the nursery so that it could not be seen from the observation window. One woman stayed at our house for a week or two after giving birth before going back to her parents' home. She was in her bedroom a lot, crying and crying. Social workers came to visit. They went into her bedroom and shut the door and talked to her. Overall, I was left with the impression that my birth was probably a sad, sad time for someone. Adoptee B said that after reuniting with her birth mother, that during her delivery, her mother had been knocked out with anesthesia, which was a common practice in the 50s and 60s. When she awoke, her baby had already been placed in temporary foster care. So for 50 years, this birth mother did not even know the gender of her own baby. Adoptee F was born with a serious heart condition, and her birth mother left the hospital not knowing if her baby had lived or died. Adoptee J observed, "We are told our whole lives how deadly of a sin sex outside of marriage is, and that's how I was created. And the only thing we are told about our birth mothers is that they are sinners." This is just some of the shame that birth mothers have had to live with. And I want you to think for a moment about what this means for birth mothers who are LDS. It means that no matter what they do, no matter how much they repent for their sins, and even if they have gone to the temple, they are sealed off from the children they place for adoption, not just in this life, but for eternity. Theirs is a sin that can never be made completely right. Next up is the second side of our triangle. And again, the media clip isn't working, but this is a clip from Modern Family where Mitch and Cam are adopting, and it very clearly presents them as a consumer couple who is entitled to have an adoptive baby. Many LDS couples turn to adoption because of infertility, although not exclusively. Some adult adoptees choose to adopt so that they can give children in need loving homes. Some altruistic couples feel called to adopt, which is admirable. But unfortunately, I have to insert here that a few of the adoptees I spoke with confided that their adoptive parents chose to adopt because it gave them social capital within their LDS communities. I want to assume that this is rare, but it can and does happen. Infertility is a tremendous loss for any couple to tackle, but in the LDS community, it is especially difficult. We value families and our genealogical lines with a zeal that reaches into eternity. And so when a couple faces the loss of that ideal, it can be disorienting and heartbreaking. I myself struggled with secondary infertility for 7 years before being able to have my two sons. And I can tell you that it challenges a woman's sense of self and value to the core. I too have cried with Rachel of old, "Give me children or else I die." And because in the LDS community, a woman's worth is often tied with her ability to multiply and replenish the earth, women who are unable to bear biological children often feel that they have failed their husbands and their God. If you've counseled couples through infertility, you will know that it causes a strain on a marriage. Even trying to get pregnant with all its timing and invasive measures brings tremendous tension into the relationship. There is a fallout that needs to be dealt with, a lot of which is learning how to cope with the loss and shame that comes from not being able to follow suit with your fellow ward members. By the time a couple arrives at adoption, they usually have suffered through a grand ordeal of fertility procedures, miscarriages, and/or the loss of a baby. Many feel broken. Adoption is the last hope they have of achieving the family they have always wanted. They've accepted the loss of their own biological bloodline and yet cannot live without having a child. Some may be in a good place with their grief and loss, but many have been so focused on the infertility and then the adoption process that their grief goes unresolved. Adoptee B shared, "About 12 years ago, I was visiting my adoptive father in the hospital after he had had surgery. I think the pain meds may have contributed to him being more open about his feelings than he ever had been, and he confessed he had never really felt that attached to his children. He said, 'When the oldest was born, I didn't want to give him my name. I kept thinking mom and I would have children of our own, and I wanted to wait to pass along my name.'" Many of us adoptees become withdrawn or angry during adolescence, particularly at our adoptive mothers, who become the stand-in for the birth mothers we feel abandon us. Adoptee K described it this way, "We learn at a young age to protect ourselves, and I had lots of trouble trusting women. Adoptive mothers bear the brunt of this burden, and for women who already feel inferior because of their infertility, this can increase their feelings of shame and inadequacy. This too can also cause a huge strain on a marriage and can re-trigger their grief because the child that was supposed to heal their wounds is now rejecting them. Some adoptive parents bury their grief only to find it resurface when we tell them we want to search for our birth families. It feels like a slap in the face, as if we're telling them they were not good enough parents, or some feel like their titles as mom or dad are being threatened. Adoptee Jay shared that when she told her dad she was going to begin searching, that he said he might as well kill himself. This is tremendous pain, unresolved grief, and shame to be carrying around. Now we're going to move on to the adoptee experience. And unfortunately, the sound is not working, but this is from the Avengers, where they're explaining why the villain, Loki, is a crazy maniac because he's adopted. We need to get some facts out of the way before we can truly discuss what adoption means for adoptees. First, adoptees are the only passive participants in the adoption process. As infants and children, we had no say in our placement, and yet our lives are forever altered by the legal documents and temple sealing ordinances that bind us to our new families. We get no vote. Many of us are content and happy with our placement, but still others, particularly those who have been abused in their adoptive homes or who have a different racial identity from their adoptive parents, are not always thrilled. Adoptee P described what it was like for her to be a mixed-race adoptee in a large white family in the early 70s. I wondered about my birth mom a lot. I didn't have a good relationship with my adoptive mom, and I have never felt like I belonged in my family or community. I grew up in Utah County, and it was very white. There were no brown kids. I was keenly aware of the fact that I wasn't blonde, that I didn't have pale skin or perfect teeth. Everything about me made me feel worse about being adopted. Adoptee D said it this way: I have spent the majority of my life trying to figure out how to fit in because I didn't fit in with my family, and being adopted and biracial has caused me a lot of pain, especially my physical appearance. During my interview process, I heard some horrific accounts of abuse, physical, sexual, and emotional, within adoptive homes. And so the idea that these children got a better life because of adoption seems ludicrous. As one adoptee who experienced acute daily abuse in her home put it, "I got a different life, but my birth mom gave me to strangers. There was no guarantee I was going to get a better life." These examples clearly demonstrate that adoption can be traumatic to adoptees. But what may not be as obvious is that adoption is always traumatic to adoptees, although some situations are more so. We know from countless studies that babies know their own mothers, that the bonding process begins in utero. As a society, we know this and we validate it. We see mothers reading to their babies while they're still in the womb, or ask for their infants to be placed on their chest right after birth. We are keenly aware of attachment and maternal bowling thanks to the work of John Bowlby. And we know when bonding and attachment are threatened that it has adverse effects on child development. In fact, one of the markers for the adverse childhood experiences study is the loss of a biological parent. We know from this study that childhood trauma increases your risk for chronic disease, addiction, depression, suicide, and social and emotional problems. Children exposed to trauma early on are more likely to experience additional trauma. We also know that these children are more likely to become pregnant as adolescents. We know that if a mom is stressed while pregnant, that her baby is also marinating in a chemical cocktail of anxiety, and that this is physically and emotionally harmful to that baby. We know that when infants are born, that they have very little sense of self, if at all, until about 9 months of age, and that they have no understanding of object permanency. They don't know if mom or dad leaves the room that their parents still exist. And yet, when we begin to talk about adoption, we forget about all that attachment, bonding, and developmental stuff and go into a state of denial. In fact, the word adoption itself is a denial. It does not represent what has actually happened between the birth mother and baby. And why is it when we read the Harry Potter series or any number of books that we readily accept the deep loss that an infant experiences when they lose their parents, but we dismiss the loss of adoptees? Do we really believe that mothers and fathers are interchangeable? Most of us go into this denial with the best of intentions. We want to believe that adoption is all about love and that it is a big band-aid that can cover up the grief of each member of the triangle. But our biology says otherwise, and as adoptees, we know this all too well. We want to believe that we are special, chosen, or a gift from God, but deep down, we don't feel that way. And we know that our reaction is a normal response to trauma. Some experts call it the primal wound, relinquishment wound, abandonment wound, or developmental post-traumatic stress disorder. But regardless, we know that it is traumatic for infants to be separated from their biological parents and that it imprints on our chemical and psychological makeup permanently. This is the first trauma. Not only is this the first trauma, but it occurs almost immediately after birth, which means, as Paul Sunderland says, there is no pre-trauma self. The second trauma that adoptees experience is the denial of the first trauma. Most adoptees are elated, or most adoptive families are elated about the adoption, and adoptees are taught to join the happy dance. We are given a script that tells us we are just fine with our adoptions, and so we learn how to follow along. This reality fracture causes dissonance in many adoptees, and some feel like they must be crazy because we're supposed to be delighted, but something feels terribly wrong. Adoptee T described it this way. I love my adoptive mom. She always told me that I didn't come from her body, but that I came straight from heaven. I felt love from her and connected to her, but I always had this hole inside, like there was something missing. I used to hide under the sink in the bathroom. I just wanted to hide, just having this big emptiness inside of me, but not understanding it at all. My adoptive parents never addressed it, but they love me and they never abandoned me. It's really hard to even put into words. Sometimes adoptees will insist that they experience no trauma of relinquishment. In fact, I used to say that too. Others will say, well, I'm sorry you had a bad experience, but mine was great. I've read up on this idea extensively and have considered my own personal motivations for insisting that adoption is only wonderful and causes no ill side effects. My assessment is, one, we learn at a young age, as I mentioned previously, to disassociate from our reality. And actually, I found that as I interviewed adoptees for this paper, frequently their responses to my questions would be from the perspective of either their adoptive or birth parents. And so I would have to ask them again to respond from their viewpoint. Two, because we had no voice in the adoption process, saying we feel like our, and we often felt like our lives are out of control. Saying that we love being adopted is a way of taking control back in a powerless situation. Three, some of us feel like we don't deserve to be hurt by adoption because we had a stable, loving home. And four, this is most important, I think, we are unspeakably afraid of losing our connection with our adoptive families. Please remember that the wound that we experienced as infants was a life-threatening one. Without care, the human infant knows it will die. And we learned as quickly as possible how to adapt to our new environment to join the happy adoption dance because our lives literally depended on it. Even as I prepared for this paper, I have had moments of severe panic and anxiety. I've had nightmares of being excommunicated from my family and community. I felt at times that if I share what I've prepared, I will surely die. Even now, I've chosen to read my paper instead of presenting script-free. This is because if I had to generate my voice here in this moment, I wouldn't be able to do it. Silence has been my home, and I know that my feelings are not reality, but that doesn't change how I feel. So we have these two traumas and they begin to create a snowball effect in our lives. Adoption has side effects. As children, we learn that unlike our peers, we have no birth story. We have an adoption story, but we have no birth story. We feel like we came from nowhere. We don't know who we look like or what kinds of hobbies we might want to pursue. We are isolated from anyone that shares our DNA. We don't know if our butts are too big or if big butts run in our family. We just don't know. Sometimes we hear our family members refer to us as their adopted family, not the real deal. Other times we hear family and friends reassure our parents that now that they've adopted a child, surely they'll be able to have one of their own. Sometimes we get into trouble at church or school when we don't want to fill out our family history sheets. Many of us have chronic stomach aches, headaches, and are diagnosed with ADD, ADHD, or depression. We have a lot of extra emotional work and stress to work out in our bodies. We may act out our rage at home or school or act the perfect child, but we worry that abandonment is just around the corner. Some of us are uncomfortable with touch and affection. We don't want to ask for a hug, even if we might need one. Some of us feel like running away, especially as children, because that's the example we feel our birth parents gave us. They ran away from us, their problem. When we hear that our mothers loved us so much that they gave us away, we feel scared that love means abandonment, or we guard ourselves as best we can from love. We plan escape routes, survival tactics, for if our loved ones die or leave us, and reassure ourselves that we will be all right without them. Our birth mother's love for us is lost in translation. In church, we hear that having a baby outside of marriage is the biggest mistake you can make, and we realize that we are somebody's worst mistake. As adolescents, many of us rebelled. We wanted to be accepted. We went looking for love in destructive ways. Too many of us had babies during our teenage years, and many of us placed them for adoption. Others became involved in abusive romantic relationships. One adoptee I spoke to was raped by a man twice her age at the age of 16 and somehow found the strength to turn him in. But over the course of the investigation, people in her family doubted her legitimacy and made her doubt her decision to press charges. She said, "It didn't take much because I was used to doubting my reality and feelings." She went back to the rapist to apologize for telling on him, and he convinced her that the only way she could make amends was if she slept with him. Adoptees are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide, and we are greatly overrepresented in addiction treatment programs. The kids are not all right. If we somehow end up in therapy, usually our therapists just don't get it. After all, many of us came from good homes with good parents. The fact that our parents wanted to adopt us at all means that they were good people, right? And as adults, many of us end up in therapy for ambiguous relationship troubles. We blame ourselves. We've always blamed ourselves. We are the bad babies that our first mothers did not want to keep. We don't trust our loved ones and wonder what's wrong with us. We feel like we need to be perfect. The perfect daughter, the perfect spouse, the perfect parent, the perfect neighbor, or else we will be thrown out. We feel we are created for other people, but not ourselves. We usually look put together and happy. You'd never know how empty we feel inside. When we become parents, we don't know if our children look like us or not. We don't know if we've given them an inheritable disease. We hope that they will give us the biological ties we never had. Sometimes we smother our children with our love, and some of us are too detached. We live in extremes. We worry about our medical history. We tire of telling the doctor, "I don't know, I'm adopted." We are anxious and depressed. We worry all the time. We think everything is going to go horribly wrong. God and faith often gets muddy, and we worry about our placement in the universe. We wonder why God's plan for us included abandonment. What did we do wrong? Why were we destined for this? Sometimes we're accused of being calloused and cruel for wanting to search for our birth families. We aren't supposed to care about our biology. Ancestors are complicated. Sometimes we claim our adoptive family line, but we also want to know where we came from too. When we're asked in church if we came from pioneer stock, we don't know which line to claim as the real one. They both seem real. And even if we go into reunion with our biological families, it's usually more emotionally jarring than we expected. After all, we've been parted with them our entire lives. Occasionally, we discover that our birth parents were married, or that we have full-blooded siblings, or that our birth families didn't want us because we're biracial. Sometimes we find that our birth mothers weren't coerced, that they were choosing between abortion and adoption. Some birth parents want money from us, and our biological families usually want us to tell them that we are elated about our relinquishment. And in that way, we are asked to join the happy adoption dance yet again. Now you've caught just a glimpse into the everyday life of the adoptee. Let's talk solutions and healing. First, you've got to let us grow up. We may have once been the adopted child, but we are now adults and our voices deserve respect. Second, let's talk about the use of the word gift as it relates to the adoptee. You're basically saying that one person's trash is another one's treasure. We don't like it. We are not objects to wrap under the Christmas tree. The term gift makes us feel like we have to be a gift for our adoptive parents our whole lives, that we never get to own ourselves. None of us like the term gift, even if we acknowledge that it comes with good intentions. Third, we are resilient. Children adapt. They can become strong through adversity. We survived, didn't we? But we also know that connection and love are the keys to resilience. And in order for us to feel connected and loved, we need to know that our trauma is respected and validated. Often, our adoptive parents are frustrated that we, their children, don't feel their love, or parents are overwhelmed by us and our endless emotional needs. But if you acknowledge the pain, the trauma, the hurt, we will begin to trust you more and more. We need to know that it's okay to be ourselves. Instead of telling us that God sent us to you, we'd like you to say, "I'm so glad you're here." We need trauma-informed care and post-adoption services. In my opinion, counseling should just be part of the adoption placement package. We need group therapy for adoptees to talk about the life cycle and grief process that comes with adoption. This isn't pathology. These are normal responses to relinquishment. Adoptive parents and birth parents could probably use therapy as well. They are dealing with tremendous amounts of grief too. And please accept that we in fact have two sets of real parents, and that wanting to reconnect with our birth families is usually part of healing from relinquishment. We want to know where we came from. Millions of people are right now searching for long-lost relatives across the globe. Why should we be excluded from that? And for some of us, learning about our genetic history is a matter of life or death. I spoke to two adoptees that likely would have died before the age of 45 had they not contacted their birth families and discovered that they needed to start screening for hereditary disease. Adoptive parents know that we can love you so, so much, but not love being adopted. It doesn't mean that you failed us or that you aren't our parents. Please know that when you insult our birth parents, you insult us. That's who we came from. When we lay eyes on our birth, or when we meet our birth families, it is usually the first time we've laid eyes on someone who shares our DNA. For me personally, it was also the first time in my life that I felt like I had an equal right to exist, same as everyone else. Finally, I would like to see us have the option to establish family orchards instead of family trees. Joseph and Julia Murdoch Smith, Emma and Joseph's adopted twins, were sealed to both sets of their parents after their deaths, biological and adopted. If we think back on the story of Moses and even Jesus, we know that children can have a destiny to fulfill in both their adopted and biological families. This shouldn't be a far reach for us. I am not pro or anti-adoption. For myself personally, adoption has been a net positive, and I feel like my life has value despite the trauma I've experienced. But shame and denial has been my cruel taskmaster. The saying goes, "We're only as sick as our secrets." Let us have no more secrets. Let us rid ourselves of the shame we have inherited. We know that love is powerful, but that power has been hindered by our shame, both collective and individual. It has cut us off from one another. Thank you for being a witness to our stories. There is a little less shame in the world right now because of your willingness to be here and to listen.
That was a very excellent presentation. I think that's the best session I've actually been to thus far.
Halfway through.
That was really great. So now we're going to open the floor for questions. We have about, 5 minutes? No. We have 20 minutes. We have 20 minutes for question and answer. So you can stand here,
okay.
And I'll just make sure that I block any.
I'm going to drink while we do.
Anybody has questions?
Yes. So, Christy, I am an adopted mom of 4 kids. My first child was adopted in 1999, and my last child was, well, that's complicated. My last two adoptions were completed in 2009, but they took 2.5 years to do because they were in foster. Anyway, so all 4 of my kids are in open adoptions.
Yes.
Because that's the era
Yes.
that we're in now. And I was 25 when we adopted our first child. so I was pretty young, pretty naive. And what we were told at the time was that open adoption was the solution to a lot of the problems.
Yes.
Of adoption. And I'm curious whether any of the adoptees that you interviewed were in open adoptions, and if you were able to discern any trends or differences between them.
Sure. So I did speak to two adoptees that were involved in open adoptions. They were actually some of the first, so in the like early 80s. And then I also spoke to some social workers, and then I spoke to some people that work exclusively with adoptees finding their birth families. And so we've talked about this a lot. And it can help as far as genetic mirroring, which is a huge thing that I addressed in the paper. However, it's not going to take away the primal wound. And so that still has to be dealt with. And so it's not that the primal wound is gonna take over a child's life, but if they have to hide it, then that is a huge barrier between us and our adoptive parents. And so, like I said, having an open adoption, it can be a good thing as far as the genetic mirroring. However, sometimes it introduces a lot of other problems, especially even among siblings. So I've talked to some adoptees where their sibling had an open adoption and theirs was a little bit more closed, even though they had pictures. And so there's jealousy between them, right? Why is mom sending me, why is my mom sending me a letter or taking me to the park and, you know, mine doesn't, right. Things like that. And so it's really complicated.
And if you have more than one child, it's virtually impossible to have the same degree of openness in
it's
multiple
not possible.
Adoptions. You can't do it.
Yeah, and I think when it comes back to that, that really we have to focus on the truth and the truth setting us free. And so, we acknowledge those primal wounds, and it's okay to comfort your child and even say, I'm sure you're missing your first mom, things like that. But then also, you know, acknowledge the differences between your kids. I'm sorry that your mom doesn't send you a letter, but I'm so glad you're here, things like that. Any other questions?
I have a question. I am fascinated by your idea of the family orchard, especially in an LDS context. Have you thought through that and sort of projected a possible future of what that could look like in the LDS church?
Well, I know as far as officially, the LDS church claims that it's not so much who you're sealed to, but rather that you have the sealing ordinance. At least that's what I've been told. But I think we have this really great precedence where the Murdoch twins, or the Smith-Murdoch twins, were sealed to both sets of their parents. And I think if we really want to focus on the fact that we're all, you know, children of Adam and Eve, why can't we be sealed to more than one person? I mean, I actually heard a heartbreaking account of a birth mom who had relinquished her baby at 15, and then she reconnected with her daughter was, I think, about 43. And she said, I've been living my whole life just hoping that if I can somehow make it to the celestial kingdom, that I can at least just visit you once. And I think that I'm not okay with that. And that's a lot of pain to be living around and feeling like you're never gonna be good enough. So I want the family orchard.
I'll tell you, I have a lot of thoughts. We had a panel yesterday on foster care and adoption. I wish that we'd had you there because I love hearing your voice and I'm really grateful. And I think it's not easy for any member of the triangle to hear. And so you were right that sometimes I would go, you know, we have guilt and we have shame and it's not healthy for any of us. Anyway, but one thing I said yesterday in our panel was, I really feel strongly, and only one of my kids' birth moms is LDS. And we actually had a visit. She came up to Montana to see us last week, and we drove all around and went to Glacier. And anyway, we have a great relationship as far as it can go, being across the country. Yeah. But one thing that I've told her and that I feel really strongly about is that the church knows how to recognize particular bonds in life.
Yeah.
You know, a male-to-female spouse and parent to child sealed bonds, and we're very limited in that, but God knows all of the love that we feel, and God knows how to recognize all of those. And just because the church doesn't know how to validate it, it doesn't make it any less real. And there is a bond between my kids and their birth families that will never go away, that God knows without question. And I see it. It's not that hard to see. That's what's real.
Thank you. Yes.
I can ask so many questions, but I'll limit it. So I'm both an adoptee and an adoptive mother.
Yes.
And we have a closed adoption with our oldest daughter. And I just wonder, and I'm sorry we were late, because I missed the beginning, and I'm bummed that I did. So
it's okay.
I'm sorry if you covered any of this or said anything about it. But do you personally have an opinion through your study at what age a child could find their birth mother? What the best age might be for a child?
That is kind of a loaded question, because I think if they're not going to find that birth parent or birth parents as an infant or just ongoing, I typically think it is better for them to be at least 18, maybe even 21, because adolescence is just a really, really hard time regardless. But then adolescence is usually when adoptees start to flip out or cave in. So that's just going to be really, really hard to actually have a productive relationship at that point. And I've seen adoptees call birth moms and say, I want to come live with you now,
yeah,
that kind of thing. So I do think that waiting till someone is an adult is often at least better, particularly because often they will not be living at home. And so you can kind of have more freedom, I think, to develop that relationship. And it really does depend on the people, how close you can get or not. I'm just recently made contact with my birth father, and I'm 35 or 36. And I've known my birth mom since I was 22, and it was not a great experience. And so I just kind of wrote that off, but getting to know my birth father has been awesome. So sometimes I think it just maturity and time needs to happen. So did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then a quick question number two, as an adopted child, especially in the church, I hated the family history sheets that we had to fill out. And even though I was sealed to my adoptive parents in the temple, I never felt like their bloodline was my bloodline. And I felt really ashamed of that.
Yeah.
Is that something that you also came upon in your...
Every single adoptee expressed that except for two that I spoke to. And these particular two had reached out to their birth families, and their birth family had come back and said, we don't want any contact. So they contacted them through a third party. And once they were told that door is completely shut, then all of a sudden they did value their adoptive family line a lot more. But I heard stories of, 8-year-olds screaming and crying, I will not fill this out. This is not my family. It's unbelievably common. So, yeah. Any other questions?
So, I was thinking about this primal wound idea, and I wonder, because I think part of it is the powerlessness of the child, right?
Yes.
They have no choice in it. So how does that, or what do you think, how it plays out in divorce? Because kids have no say in parents divorcing. They pick up new parents in the process, and they're more literally torn between,
yes,
to whom do I give allegiance, so... How does that, did you run across that?
Not as much. However, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, they do list divorce as a trauma. So that is considered childhood trauma. It's going to have adverse effects on health and emotional well-being. Also, I think I go back to this idea of the family orchard, because I think it would work better for families that are torn apart by divorce. If they feel like they can be sealed, or at least have an identity that says, I do have two moms now, I do have two dads, and yeah, the trauma has to be dealt with, but at least there's more inclusive language for how to deal with that.
I would guess there's more research on therapy for children of divorce.
Yes.
Because that seems more public. I wonder if those same therapies for the children could apply to adoptees.
I think so, and it's just still pretty under the surface. There are a few therapists that I found that only work with adoptees, but there's not very much. Most people, like I addressed in the presentation, they are kind of in denial. We want to just say, la, 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 you know, a baby can't know what happened, and yet we have amazing amounts of evidence to prove otherwise now. And I think before we just didn't know. We thought, you know, kind of the tabula rasa kind of idea that the baby's just a blank slate. And you can see the trends where we had this huge emphasis on nature and how we had to overcome that to even let people feel inclined to adopt. And then we kind of swung to this other extreme of being completely focused on nurture. And I think the truth is definitely in the middle. So, any other questions? Yes.
I loved how you said that you feel, I don't know if you said exactly this, but almost like it's crucial for an adopted child to be surrounded by other adopted children.
Yes.
In a group setting or some kind of group therapy. Do you know of any situations where that's?
I don't, and I want to start one. Yeah, I mean, I really do, because you weren't here at the beginning, but when I talked about it at the beginning, every single adoptee I spoke to, and including my own siblings, they had said, I've never talked about this with anyone before. I thought I was the only one. And even in, again, my own siblings, my brother was saying, I can't believe we've never talked about this before. And we come from a pretty open family. We talk about everything, but there's something about that shame that just really isolates us and makes us feel like we have to keep our feelings secret. And so adoptee groups that could normalize, hey, this is just your inheritance as part of being adopted. You're gonna have this grief process, and it comes in cycles. That's what a lot of the research has shown. You know, in adolescence, you have a big wave of it, but oftentimes when you get married or when you have your children, each of my births, I have three children, was really traumatic, actually, when I thought about the adoption process and bonding. I mean, with my daughter, I was just sobbing, you know, because I had her in the hospital for almost 4 days, and I was relinquished at 3 days from my birth mom, and I was just saying to her, I choose you, I choose to keep you, and I didn't know where that was coming from. I was in complete denial, but it was extremely traumatic. So, and then of course, as you grow older and you're starting to become involved in family history, there's a whole nother process of how do I reconcile that? And so we need support groups to talk about these things.
So since you have adopted siblings also,
yes.
I have many questions for you. but if your parents had tried to encourage you and your siblings to talk about your process, do you think you would have, or would you have just looked at your parents and met? Why are you involved in this?
Well, these are my parents right here. They're awesome and very open and cool. And, you know, they did talk to us about adoption, and they never sat us down and told us we were adopted. We just always knew. And my two younger sisters are mixed race, and so it was obviously obvious that we were an adoptive family. And my parents would openly discuss it, but I think, you know, we just go back to that, I don't want to hurt my adoptive parents. And actually, that's one of the things that I notice as I talk to adoptees, is we're hyper aware of how our birth parents will our adoptive parents will react to the things that we say. And some adoptive parents actually get really, really angry, because it is threatening, especially if you were told that this was your big band-aid that was gonna cure your, you know, whatever, your infertility or your pain or whatever. So I think my parents were open about that, and yet we felt like we couldn't talk about it. So if
so
they're
you would have needed a group separate from your parents.
Yeah, probably again some professionals to kind of lead the discussion, and then someone to say, hey, have you ever experienced this? Oh, you have? That's normal. Because that was another thing that I noticed as I spoke with adoptees, is lots of times they would tell me something and they'd say, has anyone else said that? And I'd say, oh yeah, every single one. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh yeah, I've always thought that way. I never knew that was normal. But there's something about needing to feel validated, like, oh, that is normal. That's okay for me to be a little bit angry that this happened, or depressed, or, you know, when I'm supposed to be grateful. We do kind of inflict gratitude, I think, on adoptees. So any other questions? Yes.
So when you said that the experience of meeting your birth parents or your birth mother was not a good one, do you have any advice? Because we know who the birth parents are, even though it's a closed adoption.
Uh-huh.
We ended up getting some documents sent to us from the courthouse that gave us names. We know who they are.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, we know they're on Facebook and everything else.
Okay.
Wish doctor.
Yeah, oh, hey, I've done that too. I did that a long time before I reached out to my birth dad. So,
what do you think would be a good way of reaching out to kind of start that process in a couple of years?
It kind of depends, because depending on the laws, you have to be careful of the laws. For example, I was adopted in Arizona, and you have to use a third party. At least that's the legal process. And so if there is some sort of legal process, I would encourage you to follow that.
Even if you're 18 or older?
Even if you're 18.
Oh.
Yeah, it depends on the state. So if it's Utah, I'm not exactly sure about what the legal limits are. But I do think if you have a third party intervene and contact the person and say, is this something you're interested in, that can be effective, because sometimes birth families get really worried and shy about being contacted. And so it's just kind of a way to ease that tension. And then you can say, I'm available, I'm interested, here's my contact information, or whatever the process is. But I think it's good to be a little bit cautious, because a lot of people... it's just really emotionally jarring. When my birth mother contacted me at 22, it totally threw me for a loop, and I didn't know what to do about it for a few months. And then finally I was like, okay, I think I can handle this. So I think it's just taking it slow, because if you do it too fast, it's just really overwhelming. So did that answer your question?
Can I interject?
Yeah.
So one of our daughters did that process recently, and she found out that her birth mother had died in 1993, but her birth grandparents were still living. And she had to go through the same process to contact them. They were in their late 70s, and you'd think, but they had to sign an affidavit agreeing to contact. And I thought, why would, you know, I mean, the birth mom's dead, but it's that legal complication.
Yeah.
And it worked out great, but it was more complicated than we would have thought.
Well, and I will insert that I'm very much for adoption reform. I don't think I like the idea that birth certificates are altered. I think that that's really odd. And I do think that all adoptees are entitled to at least know medical information about their genetic background. And I think some states that have handled this really well is that they have a registry where all the information is there for at least adults to reach it, so even adoptive parents can look it up. But if for some reason a birth mother or a birth father does not want to be contacted, they can have something that says, you know, they've elected to not have their information here. And I think that that would be better, because most birth parents want to be found. It's pretty rare that they don't. I only encountered 2 of the 20 that I spoke to, but then other adoptees I've spoken to, it's like they're just waiting. They're waiting for their kids to contact them. So if that were a little bit easier, I think that everyone would be better off.
I think we've reached the end of the session. Please hear a hand.